Welcome to Health Hats, empowering people as they travel together toward best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege, living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in healthcare's Tower of Babel. Let's make some sense of all of this. Marla Jan Wexler is a registered nurse. She supports young people with stories similar to hers, congenital heart defects and open heart surgeries. In this 12th episode in the series about young adults with complex conditions, Marla Jan relates her evolution from child to a person advocating for herself to an advocate for others. She describes the challenges of leveraging been there, done that experience while gauging the readiness of young adults and parents to hear those lessons that she's learned. Finally, Marla Jan opens her heart, so to speak, to her struggles with PTSD and finding compassion for herself. I so appreciate this conversation with Marla Jan. She's one of my heroes. We found common ground in the value we found in our career in nursing, our restlessness in our careers in life, our empathy for the people we serve, and the humor that bubbles up from our spiritual core and life circumstances. Good morning. I'm with Marla Jan Wexler.
Got it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good. Marla Jan, how do you introduce yourself in a social situation?
I feel like that's a loaded question.
Okay.
I mean, it depends on the type of situation.
Okay.
Is it a more professional social situation?
Sure. Or? Start with that.
Yeah, I mean, if it's something like this, like the event we're at now.
Okay. We're at the Palliative Care Conference.
Yes.
Okay.
I would approach someone, say, hi, my name's Marla Jan Wexler. I'm a patient advocate. I'm a nurse. You know, and kind of get into what I do and
okay.
why I'm here.
Okay. When did you first realize that health was fragile?
For me, it's been my entire life.
Okay.
I was born with a complex congenital heart defect. My parents were told I wouldn't make it past 2. Spoiler alert, I'm here, I'm 37. But I've always known at a young age that health is really fragile. I think as a child, I didn't necessarily not take it for granted. I didn't completely understand the enormity with just how sick that I was. Mm-hmm. But I think I knew from a young age that things could go bad quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the other side of that. So you've had health issues all your life, and since you were conscious, you knew it.
Mm-hmm.
So what does healthy look like?
For me personally, healthy is being able to get out of bed every day, be able to do the tasks that I want to complete, be able to socialize and do those types of things that I would like to. But healthy also comes with taking handfuls of pills every day and injecting myself with medication and some degree of pain no matter what. So I think my idea of health is slightly skewed.
Yeah. It is interesting how perspective will adjust your view. When did you start wanting to speak for yourself. terms of your health.
In terms of my health, I spoke. It's funny. I did some advocacy work for the hospital that I work for. As you know, I'm a nurse as well. Mm-hmm. And they have what they call a heart and mind education day. And I would speak to teenagers on having congenital heart disease and transitioning from, pediatric care to the adult world, going on to college, things like sex, birth mm-hmm. control, mm-hmm. drugs and drinking, all the things that kind of go through the mind of someone going away to college. So I did do that. And I guess I don't necessarily consider that like advocacy work, but it wasn't until I started my blog in 2012 and started getting a little bit of a following and realizing that my voice really could have an impact.
That's how I first was introduced to you, was through your blog and then through this conference.
Through this conference 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I won. When I first started my blog, it was really just a means to vent. Mm-hmm. I didn't think anyone but like my mom would read it. And I'm not a writer. Again, I'm a nurse, so mm-hmm. writing is not my forte for sure. But I won the WeGo Health Hilarious Activist Award in 2014. And that's really what snowballed me into realizing that I can do more than mm-hmm. just writing my blog. I can go out there and speak and share my story and, mm-hmm. and try to make changes mm-hmm. in healthcare for patients like us.
So go back to say 10, 12 and speaking up for yourself. Either at school or at the doctor's office, where did you begin to transition in your mind from, my mom or my parents are looking out for me to I'm looking out for myself?
I would say probably around the age of 16. My cardiologist at the time, my parents always came with me to the appointments. And cardiologist came out like, oh, I'm just going to see Marla for a little bit.
Okay.
What?
Oh.
And I remember he sat me down. He drew me a picture of my defect, basically the surgeries that I had and how they repaired it, and said, you need to know this stuff. You're 16 years old. You're going to be going away to college. I think it was between my junior and senior year of high school when mm-hmm. he did that.
Yeah.
And I just remember being like blown away and like, oh yeah, I guess I really am going to make it. And now I have to start taking the reins and taking control of my health. Mm-hmm. And my parents were actually quite good about it. Once I turned 19, I started going to my appointments by myself and speaking up mm-hmm. and really just taking control and scheduling the appointments and going to the tests. Mm-hmm. I think there was 1 year I skipped and I still hear about that from my mother, but I skipped going to for like my, I go twice a year and I have my big annual visit where I get MRI, echo, stress test. Oh, and skipped that one.
You blew it off.
I did blow it off.
Okay. How did you end up deciding to go to nursing school?
So it's funny. My nursing degree isn't my first degree.
Okay.
I went to school for biology and I minored in law and justice thinking I was going to be the next, like Olivia Benson mm-hmm. from Special Victims Unit. I wanted to be a forensic pathologist.
Okay.
And I saw my first autopsy and passed out.
Oh, okay.
And then after I graduated with my degree, I started working in a lab. Realize you don't get to work for the FBI right away. You don't go to crime scenes right away. You actually have to put your time in. And I hated like the cold sterility of the lab mm-hmm. and quit after like a week. Mm-hmm. Started bartending, mm-hmm. Much to my parents' dismay. Mm-hmm. And I guess at age 20, because I took about a year off between and before I realized like, oh, nursing, I feel like I would love it. And I always remembered how amazing the nurses were, when I was the sick one in the hospital as a mm-hmm. kid. And even something as simple as like drawing little hearts and flowers on the hat that goes in the toilet that you pee in, mm-hmm. Just to make it like a little more personal mm-hmm. and fun. Mm-hmm. No one wants to pee in a hat. Just remembering things like that. And I had a nurse that I loved. Her name was Maria. And she always let me sit at the nurse's station with her and would give me like blank nurse's mm-hmm. notes and let me fill out my own stuff, like the patient, and let me mm-hmm. listen to her. And I just, it really resonated with me. And I realized like, oh, that's what I should be doing. I shouldn't be stuck in a lab or stuck at crime scenes.
You go to nursing school and not only are you an older student who's already been to school, but you're
not that much older. I know, I'm kidding.
Well, yeah, not out of high school.
Not out of high school, I know, I'm kidding.
But also, you're a person who's received a lot of nursing care. My experience, so I'm a nurse too, and my experience was that people in school seemed so focused on the skills of nursing that they didn't really, it took a while to appreciate the recipient of nursing care and what they were going through. But here you were, somebody who has been part of the medical system all your life and has seen both good and bad nursing care. So how was that, being in school, you know, having that perspective, which might have been unique of the students?
It certainly was an interesting perspective. I mean, you know, I still was like single focused on task at hand mm-hmm. and not necessarily like the empathy and compassion that go into nursing. But once we got into clinical rotations and I was actually human to human and not, you know, putting a Foley in a dummy. Mm-hmm.
A Foley catheter.
A Foley catheter, sorry. I realized that I felt like I was able to take my experiences and turn it into mm-hmm. compassion and nursing care.
Okay. So now you're older and you have been managing your medical issues. Mm-hmm. And you've been a nurse for a while. From that vantage point, what would you recommend to young adults and their parents as they begin to transition to adult care? What would you, in hindsight, what would you advise?
It's start sooner rather than later.
Start sooner.
Rather than, and we were talking about this yesterday. I told you how I became very passionate in my work with transitioning care from pediatric to adult medicine. And with some of the research I've done, it's around age 14 is when it should start.
Okay.
Just that process in general, because it shouldn't be, okay, next time you're across the street at the big boy hospital. It needs to be a process not only for the patient and the provider, but also for the caretakers. Okay. It's a huge learning curve. And I was very lucky that my parents were, you know, understanding and good about it and actually let go of the reins.
Okay.
Because it can, sometimes it's the caretakers that do more of the hindering.
Okay.
And just aren't comfortable, feel like, you know, the patient can't take care of themselves, can't do this for themselves. And
so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy or could be a self-fulfilling.
It could be, but it definitely is something that I think is a years-long process, which I know sounds like a long time, but it's life and it's not. It's probably not enough time. Maybe it should start easier. But and as I was saying yesterday, I feel like it should start with simple tasks, like, you know, especially now that we're in such a tech-driven society, you know, download the CVS app and teach your child how to refill their own prescription. Like, you don't even have to talk to anyone anymore. You just hit a button. Mm-hmm. Make your own appointments. You know, maybe at age 15, really start to learn your disease, defect, what have you. Learn your medications, why you take them, and their names, and not just blue pill that makes me pee, blood pressure medicine. Like, know why you're taking them and really be that person, be that expert for yourself.
Again, with your vantage point, how would you advise nurses or nursing schools or, you know, the clinical folk to be more welcoming of the as people cross a threshold from pediatric to adult care?
It needs work. The process is not great right now. Some transition programs are better than others. And it also depends what type of nursing. Like if you're at the bedside in an ICU or even like a, and I just say cardiac because that's what I do and know, even in like the cardiac step down unit, it might not always be the right time, the right place to bring up transition. You know, you make those relationships with patients and families where you feel you can talk more and be more open and even about your own life in general. Those types of patients, I always feel like I was able to openly have those conversations. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I would say something to a mom about like their 17-year-old, oh, well, you know, we're really starting that process. And they're like, oh my God, we don't talk about it. And it's almost like this urban legend of transition. Like we know it's going to happen, but we don't want it to happen. And I think specifically for nursing, you know, it needs to start more in the clinic than at the bedside inpatient.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because when you're inpatient, you're already so stressed anyway that there's, you know, you're clearly there for a reason, whatever it is. And maybe bringing up that whole process like, oh, look at the hearts and flowers now, but in a couple years, you're going to be next door. I think there's a time and place to bring up that process. Yeah. And it does need to happen, but you also need to have that compassion and empathy and that little bit of, you know, knowing that that there is a correct place for it to happen.
See the show notes or my website, www.health-hats.com, for more information or to subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks.
So you're pretty comfortable talking about yourself and the challenges you have, and you're being the funniest, you know, website. You know, your sense of humor in your work is striking. But I just have a sense that you grew into that.
Oh, for sure.
That that it's sharing your experience with young people that you're nursing is something that you've that's evolved.
Yeah,
so not only have you evolved, so first, how have you evolved in your comfort and how you share?
You know, but before the lupus and the cancer and everything,
it isn't just, you're not just dealing with that you had a heart defect,
no.
But okay, well, we'll
get into that.
We'll get into that.
You know, as a kid, as an adolescent, even into college, like I didn't really talk about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, people saw my scars, what's that from? I wear a med alert bracelet, but you know, at that age, you just don't want to be seen as different,
right?
You know, ever. You know, I went through that phase where I hid my scars and gave my parents hell because, you know, I couldn't do the things my peers could do. And so I think at that point, like I certainly hadn't grown into being comfortable sharing my story. Mm-hmm. Once I started my nursing career and started working with congenital heart disease patients, you know, and it's not like I walked into a room like, hey, my name's MJ, I'm your nurse, and been there, done that. So, you know, you have to build relationships and rapport with your patients and their families. And I wasn't comfortable talking about it with everyone I took care of. But, you know, you form those relationships and those bonds where you feel comfortable talking about yourself. And I did feel that, you know, once I did create that more trusting relationship, that I could talk to a patient, you know, especially like a teenage patient who the last thing they want to do after open heart surgery is their incentive spirometer or getting out of bed or, you know, all that they eat and drink. And, you know, I could really sit down and I'm like, listen, like I've been there. I'm probably in that same bed you're sitting in on this unit. I know what it's like. I know how awful it is, but I'm telling you, it helps and it gets better. I promise it gets easier. And those are the patients that truly listened. And you know, sometimes it was a hindrance. I had a parent who I hadn't shared what I had been through. And I, you know, maybe I was a little tougher on some of my patients because I knew that's what they had to do. I knew, like, all right, if I had to do it before fentanyl and Dilaudid, they're sure as hell getting up and doing it now. And I had a couple patients, or excuse me, a couple parents say that I was a little hard and they thought that I was pushing their kids too much. And I remember with one parent, she was quite angry with me and yelling at me. And I kind of, you know, was able to bring down the tension a little bit and just say, listen, like, I've been there. Like, I've done this. I know what it's like. And it changed the entire trajectory for the rest of their admission in the hospital. Because the mom realized there was a method to my madness. For lack of better words.
I'm sure it was sobering to hear that.
It was, yeah. And she was like, you know, oh my gosh, I had no idea. And I never wanted to be about me. That's another reason why I'm not always comfortable. Within the context of my work as a nurse in the hospital, wasn't always comfortable sharing my story because I never wanted it to not be about the patient. But I remember that vividly, just the tension just
dissipated.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, okay, whatever his name is, you're getting out of bed. And he looks at his mom like, you know, like, wait, I thought. And she was like, no, this is what you got to do. She, you know, knows what she's talking about. You're going to do it. And, you know, and you won't know as a nurse, like getting out of bed and your incentive spirometer, all that crap you don't want to do is either
gets
you home faster.
It does, right.
You know, if you don't, you get the risk of pneumonia and pleural effusions, and you'll be back.
Yeah.
You will be back in clots and all those things that, you know, we don't necessarily, as a patient, think of because we're like, the last thing we want to do is take a deep breath and let the little ball thingy go up. But for the most part, it's definitely been, I've been able to make it a positive in my work.
What do you look for as a nurse in when you're gauging readiness for either the young adult or the parent? Like, what gives you the, you know, helps you know where they are on the continuum and how ready they are for you to help them push ahead a few degrees? What do you look for? What do you see? Like, what are you seeing as you're gauging that? I'm sure you're not always doing it consciously, but you've done it so much and you've lived it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think specifically. Not necessarily. So before I worked in the cardiac ICU, I worked on an apheresis unit.
Okay, and that, what's that?
Apheresis, it basically looks like a big dialysis machine.
Okay.
And whereas dialysis filters and cleans your blood, apheresis is an exchange. So our main population was sickle cell, kids with sickle cell. So in sickle cell, your red blood cells are diseased. The patients got hooked up, whether port or through peripheral IVs, they got hooked up to the machine, one tube, pulled their blood out of their body. It goes through a centrifuge. It separates off the diseased red blood cells, goes into a waste bag. The patient gets back their white blood cells, the buffy coat, you know, all the other components of their own blood and got healthy donor blood, donor red blood cells.
Okay.
So I did that for a few years. Like you, I like to bounce around. So I did that for a few years. And, you know, those patients came every 3 or 4 weeks. So over the years, you get to know them, you get to know their families, and I really gauged it on their readiness, the questions, if they ask questions about their disease, if they were, you know, if I noticed they were paying a little more attention to the machine and a little more engaged and interested in what actually was going on and not just there for their treatment, I would really start the process. I did, what else did I do? I did we had bulletin boards, so I did a big transition to care board. And it's funny because the medical director of apheresis basically wrote the book on pediatric apheresis. She's still the medical director. I think she's probably in her 80s. And she wanted nothing to do with that. She didn't want to give up her patients. Like, that was her life that she poured out, you know, her life's work that she poured everything into. But I really gauged it on patients asking questions, parents asking questions. If I notice kids coming to treatments by themselves, I was like, well, if you can come to your treatment by yourself, then it's time to really learn your disease. And That's where I gauged it there. From a cardiac standpoint, when I worked at the bedside in the ICU, it was a little different because I was taking care of critically ill patients. Yeah. When they were ready to go to the step-down unit, and again, as I mentioned earlier, if I had that type of bond and relationship, I would bring it up, especially with the teenage population. And if the parents weren't in the room, I would sneak in those conversations about drinking, drugs, sex that, you know, you don't want to, as a 16-year-old, talk about
with your parents,
yes. around. And that's a huge thing because I was very realistic, I think, because I went through it, you know, and my poor mother, you know, not necessarily that she drilled into my head, like, if you do those things at college, you're going to die. But, you know, she drilled into my head, like, don't do those things. I was 18 years old, what my first taste of freedom. What's the first thing I did? Went to a frat party and had beer. And I think we need to have realistic expectations for our patients, especially with the transition process, and especially with something that's lifelong and something where, you know, if they've spent an exorbitant amount of time in the hospital as a child, going away to college, like, you want to feel that independence and you want to feel like your peers.
Is your approach sort of a harm reduction approach?
Harm reduction.
That you're going to drink and here's what is going to happen and here's how you handle it.
And some parents were horrified. How could you, you know, why? Really? Like, do you really think, and, you know, do you really think, and not just drinking and drugs, but like safe sex, and especially for the patients who had a genetic component to their condition, like these are the things you have to think about. You know, if you have unprotected sex, and you know, your Susie gets knocked up, and these are the things you have to think about. And also with sickle cell, my sickle cell patients, it's a huge component, obviously, the genetic piece that goes into it. And I think, maybe not so much in this generation, but in my generation, they were so hell-bent on keeping us alive that no one had those conversations with us. So we were coming back from college sick sometimes because no one had those conversations. No one told us.
So when you say no one told us, have you always felt like you're part of a community of people? When you say us, so it's
no, okay. Never.
All right.
I didn't feel like part of a community until probably once the adult health issues came to fruition. I always felt like I was alone. No one understood what I went through. I didn't know anyone else who had had open heart surgery, let alone four. So no, I did feel very alone. So when I say us, I mean that more in my adult life with chronic illness. But now it's much more, especially with social media and patient advocacy groups and support groups. Those things didn't exist then. So I did feel alone. But now with those, like our patients and us, I say in air quotes, feel more supported and feel like they have people behind them.
Yeah. So do you let young people know that, like, sort of you vetted some groups, like, here's a URL of or a Facebook page or go here. Yeah. Like, here's a good community that you can plug into.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I have.
And I assume people are open to that because people.
Yeah, much more so now, of course, to talk and to communicate and learn and. You know, we can all learn something from each other, especially if we've all been through the same thing. I always find it very fascinating to see how people have evolved differently.
Yeah. So what should I be asking you that I haven't?
What should you be asking me? Talked about transition. I mean, I could tell you about like my adult life.
Please tell me a little bit about your adult life.
So in 2008, my husband and I got married at the end of February. We went on our honeymoon 10 days in St. Lucia where we just baked in the sun. And 3 weeks after we got home, I woke up and looked like Shrek. My face was swollen. I was covered in rashes. And that was the beginning of my journey to getting a diagnosis of lupus. And from that point, from lupus turned into diagnosis of several other overlapping autoimmune diseases to a cervical cancer diagnosis, which it's such on the back burner for me of all the things I've been through. Like cervical cancer was just kind of like this little blip. And then in 2014, I underwent a double mastectomy when a lump was found in my breast.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And it completely changed. All of that changed my life exponentially, changed the direction of my career.
Because you didn't necessarily have the energy.
So my first several years with my lupus diagnosis, I was still working in the cardiac intensive care unit. I was back in school for my master's degree and just running myself ragged. I was kind of in denial that, lupus is an invisible disease. I figured if I can't see it, it's not really there. If I act like it's not there, then it can't hurt me. And in 2012, found out that lupus started attacking my heart, I already had cardiac issues, and that was kind of my wake-up call. I remember my rheumatologist after, I was in the midst of a horrible flare. I lost 15 pounds in 2 weeks. Like, I was a mess, couldn't get myself out of bed. And I remember her looking at me and Marla Jan, you have to respect the lupus. And I was like, oh, I guess I do. And that was really my wake-up call. Once I realized that lupus was more than just some joint pain and rashes, it affected my organs and affected my life exponentially. I took what was supposed to be a 6-week leave of absence from the cardiac ICU, and that turned into 5 years on disability. And I got very, very, very sick before I even started to get better. Like we were talking about yesterday, I was on extreme high dose steroids. I gained 65 pounds in 6 weeks. I walked with a walker, with a cane for about 9 months. The lupus also affected my lungs and my brain, took a little bit of a cognitive hit, never finished my master's degree. I was a semester and a half away from being a pediatric nurse practitioner. I mean, it changed everything. And unfortunately, my brand new marriage just couldn't handle all of that. And we got divorced. Our divorce was finalized in the end of 2017. So we had a good run.
Wow.
Almost 10 years, but...
Well, that's a lot.
And
my experience with you, which is, two conferences and following your blog, you seem to have a strong spiritual core. And I know nothing about religion in you, but that's not really what I mean. But I mean a sense of your own self-worth. That there's a strength there that's helped you get through all this.
It's so funny. On the outside, I have this superwoman persona. And I think it was almost not from my parents, or I think it was almost expected from me as a young child. And, this is a lot of what I'm speaking about today at this conference, the severe, complex PTSD that I've been living with my entire life and never did anything about until about a year ago. Started seeing a therapist who specializes in complex trauma and started really working on myself from, I have my religion. I'm not a very religious person. It's important to me, but it's not, it doesn't encompass my everything. I'm much more spiritual, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's just really working on myself and finding this kind of strength in myself that I knew was there. And, almost like that talk that we just listened
heard,
to
right.
about self-compassion, I have none. Even now, I don't have as much, I don't have much, if at all. And I'm learning that I need to.
Yeah.
And it's okay to be compassionate for myself and take care of myself and do what I need to do mentally and physically. I've come a long way.
Wow. Thank you.
Of course.
This is great. Thanks for spending the time with me.
Yeah, of course. Loved it.
Many times during the interview, I wanted to stop and hug Marla Jan. Sometimes for me and sometimes for her. She touched me. Unfortunately, lapel mics and hugging don't mix well. Finding the silver lining in our dilemmas, balance the bitter with the sweet. Marla Jan sees the silver linings. Silver linings hold us up when the shell wants to crumble. While Marla Jan told us that you can't just walk in and say, been there, done that, actually she did. And it was life-changing for her charges. I wanted to cry as I edited this interview, as I heard again that cervical cancer was on the back burner when lupus and breast cancer knocked her over. I was going to end this series after two more interviews that are ready to produce, but I think I'll add another one about PTSD. I know just who to invite. So, Marla Jan, love you. Thanks for inspiring me. Follow my blog, podcasts, and resources through my website. See you around the block.